Welcome to Lives in Leadership. This podcast is dedicated to promoting thoughtful and strategic conversations about military leadership, ethics, culture, and service in the profession of arms within the Australian Defence Force. My name is Dr. Lucas Mari, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Florence Gaub, a Franco-German researcher, security expert, and futurist, who's currently working as the director of the research division at the NATO Defence College in Rome. Dr. Gaub also serves on the World Economic Forum's Global Future Council on Complex Risks, and she's previously worked as deputy director of the EU Institute for Security Studies and as a foresight advisor for the EU Council. Florence, welcome to the Lives in Leadership podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There seems to be a lot of hype and discussions at the college in Australia and the world, perhaps, about artificial intelligence, about AI and the future, and the future of technological advancements in warfighting and in the military. And particularly, there's a lot of discussions about how AI is a game changer, you know, how it's going to change warfighting and military operations. Is AI the game changer that people are saying it is? And, you know, what do you have any thoughts on this, or does NATO have any thoughts on AI and the future?
I mean, we're part of the debate as much as everybody else. I will say that, first of all, we need to perhaps rephrase what a game changer is. I think that there's a lot of hype. You know, drones were described as a game changer. The internet is described as a game changer. But the question is it a true revolution, as in does it change fundamentally, in our case, the character and nature of war? Or is it an add-on to something that already exists? And I would say it's probably more the latter. I don't think the reason why people go to war, how they go to war, how they conduct war, is fundamentally going to change. That's just because when you look at studies done since the end of World War II, you see a surprising continuity in even, for instance, land warfare operations. So there's a lot of hype, and you know, regularly every decade there's a revolution announced in, you know, the field that we work on, and we find it's an evolution, not a revolution. So when it comes to AI, I always compare it to electricity in that we won't know the full extent until we've tried and tested it. So it's very much something we have to apply to see what it can do. I think as we speak today, we're all in a bit of a not delusion, but the bubble has burst a little bit on what especially generative AI can do. We find that it's making many mistakes, that you can't really trust it. And, you know, if you want to have AI assist you in military decision making, obviously the number one condition is trust. And I don't think we have that right now. So I think, ask me again in a year, in 5 years. At the moment, I will say the greatest potential is in the areas that are not super sexy, flashy, strategic, like, okay, AI can help us maintain logistics because it's going to be better than us at anticipating when certain equipment needs repair or maintenance and all that. So at the moment, I think it's going to be more in those areas, and it's going to be super useful for that. But I just don't think, you know, we published a graphic novel last year, NATO 2099, you can also see it on our website, in which AI plays a key role. So I don't want to spoil the story for the listeners, but there is an AI called the War Predictor, and the War Predictor in the story at some point says war probability 100%. So I leave the cliffhanger there, but I don't think that scenario is imminent. I don't think we'll have an AI let us decide fundamentally human affairs, and war fundamentally is a human affair, first and foremost.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think the same sorts of discussion and debates happen in the field of sustainability and climate change. It's like there's a lot of technological advancements, mm-hmm. and people are kind of looking at that as a sort of silver bullet solution. It's going to be a game changer. You know, we're going to solve all these sort of global poverty and climate change. And, you know, I don't know if the evidence, you know, there's the technology, the science is one thing, and the technology to solve those things, I think is another. And I hear the same sorts of discussions with AI that it's...
I mean, technophilia is a real thing, right? People get really excited about technological innovation because it's a bit like the promised land, you know, like finally we don't have to go through all these painful changes because we'll have the silver bullet in the shape of technology. And you see that in many areas. Now, what's super interesting is that be it old science fiction, when you look at, you know, watch Blade Runner, for instance, from the 80s or even before, there is always overemphasis on technology. The same goes if you read Lawrence Friedman, The Future of War History. When it comes to how we used to think about the future of war, there's always overemphasis on technology and underestimating the human aspect of it, right? So you watch old science fiction, you see that people don't cook anymore, people don't go into nature, people don't do all those things that we actually still enjoy doing today because it's easier to think about tech than it is to think about all these classical human things, right? So I think that's normal. It's also seductive because it means, it looks like there's a shortcut to all these problems. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think it's probably overstating the impact of technology.
No, I agree. And do you think the militaries that you've had the pleasure of kind of working with have perhaps a bias towards thinking about the technology in the future, kind of emphasizing the technological future capabilities rather than the human aspect of their
so
futures?
So I'll say yes, but there are two schools of thought on that. You'll have those that fundamentally think about how war is being fought. So there's a very dominated by technophilia. But then you also have those, and I'm part of that group, but I'm not the only one. You know, HR McMaster, for instance, is also part of that. We think more Clausewitzian in the sense that what does Clausewitz say is that fundamentally war is a fundamentally human phenomenon. It's about why. We should ask much more about why do people actually start fighting with each other and for what reason rather than how. And I think I find this question more interesting, but as I said, it's less. You have nothing to show for. I don't have a cool slide with a new weapon that will change everything if I ask a question that's thousands of years old, right? So I think I won't say all of military officers have a tendency to think tech. I think it's very much also service dependent. If you are like the Air Force or of course in the cyber domain, you have to be tech oriented. But I find that, you know, the Navy or the Army tend to be a bit less about the fundamental question. I'm overgeneralizing, but that's my experience.
And I guess a counter kind of thought to that is in the ethics space in which people talk about AI maybe removing the human elements of warfare. You know, not that there isn't a human element, but that, you know, I think of my mind goes to the trolley problem, you know, the aspect of, for those that aren't aware of that example, sometimes it's articulated as a choice between, you know, pushing a button and pushing someone over a bridge, and that, you know, the studies show that the human kind of aspect of having to do the act like up close in person was a lot harder because of the ethical implications that one has to go through to do that. Whereas pushing the button from far away seems less removed, and AI maybe.
There's even the other question, the other scenario, which is, for instance, about self-driving cars, where they ask people, okay, so the car detects a situation where it's either about running over a child or killing the driver. The vast majority of people will say, well, of course, it should kill the adult driver. Except when you ask them, okay, you're the driver. Then they're like, well, see. So there are no universal conclusions from a certain situation, which is why I think even though our fear that AI will decide over life and death is I think it's a valid fear to have. But I also think that until we've cracked that philosophical conundrum or moral conundrum, I don't think it's going to happen. I also don't think China or Russia would be super cavalier about it. Maybe more cavalier than Western nations, but I also think, remember, it's about trust. It's can you trust the system? And it's also about consequences. Can an AI think through consequences? Can it actually have completely novel ideas? You know, perhaps in the future, but like the distant future, but I think in the next 10 years, I just don't think that.
Yeah, interesting. I might just pivot a bit because I when I was reading the bio of yourself, Florence, it says you're a futurist, and I guess I don't exactly know what that means. Can you maybe explain to our listeners what a futurist is and does?
So some people prefer the term strategic foresighter, the term futurist. Also, there are many futurists that don't want to be called a futurist. But I think if you think of it as somebody who thinks about the future in a structured and conscious and I'm going to say scientific way, then you're a futurist. Meaning, so scientific way means, oh, I'm not just going to write down all my fears and what imagine my imagination can bring about, like aliens and whatever, but doing the research, seeing what do the trends say, what different causalities are possible, how do others think about the future? That, for instance, I think is a very interesting aspect, like how does Russia think about the future of its, you know, the world or war or whatever. It could be on any kind of topic. I love watching science fiction from other countries, for instance, because it tells you a lot about how these societies think about the future. So it is, at the end of the day, what I do for NATO is a lot of scenario analysis, writing scenarios, but also, you know, weak signal searching. What's weak signal searching is that my radar is constantly looking for new developments that might be ongoing or coming up. You know, there's this term like the signal and the noise. Not every beep that you hear is actually the beginning of a new trend, but it can be, and that's also part of my job. So looking at, I'm reading The New Scientist. I don't know if you know New Scientist, the British science magazine. That's why I said I'm watching science fiction. I'm reading lots of different things just to see, is there anything that's about to change that could be interesting for us? That's what a futurist does.
Wonderful. And so weak signals means certain types of evidence or data that you feel is...
Exactly. A weak signal is a sign that a trend is being born, right? It's the early stages of a trend. What is a trend? A trend is a pattern of change, right? So a trend is not, you know, let's say the sun rises and sets every day. That's not a trend because it doesn't change. So it's fundamentally about detecting the beginnings of a change that could be interesting for you. So I'll give you one example. New software. It's a good thing to have a look at new softwares that are coming out because they can change things. Android, for instance, if somebody had understood the impact of Android on geopolitics, that would have been very good in terms of weak signal detection. Why? Because Android meant that suddenly the internet was available for a lot of people on their phones. Before that, it was only the iPhone. The iPhone was very expensive. But Android arrived on the market, made it a lot cheaper to have the internet on your phone, which then, you know, that happened in 2008. And in 2010, the Arab Spring started. Mm-hmm. It had a role in that because most people in the Middle East didn't access Facebook from their desktops, but from their phones. But 2 years before that, they couldn't have afforded an iPhone. So detecting a new software, detecting anything very early before the others do, or not the others, before it's public before the public is aware of that, mm-hmm. That's weak signal detection. And it's weak signal because it's very early, right? So you don't have mega evidence yet.
And what does your research division or the NATO Defence College in general try to make sense of with those weak signals? I know you've talked about what if scenarios, mm-hmm. or you talked about scenario. Can you maybe explain to us what that is and how it works?
So we have, for instance, once a year we bring out a collection of what if scenarios. And so the researchers are free in choosing their topic. The only thing they have to do is bring me a scenario that's based on a weak signal set 5 years in the future. So weak signal means they have to have some evidence. It's not just, oh yeah, I think aliens are coming. And then they have to think through the consequences of that. Of course, we work for NATO, so we look at it for, you know, consequences for NATO. And then we also look at the present. What can we do now and in the coming years to mitigate the effects or maybe avoid this scenario altogether? One weak signal that a colleague of mine identified was panic over, you know, rumors over a bioweapon. And, you know, we don't have strong evidence of a bioweapon, but we have evidence of people freaking out over it. And so he thought through not the effects of a bioweapon, but the fear of such a weapon. What could that do, actually? Can it be manipulated? Can you actually use that as a weapon, the fear itself? So that is, for instance, one example. I think it's a very good one.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially in a post sort of COVID era in which mm-hmm. people talking about it as a weapon or it being developed in a lab or, you know, these sorts of...
Yeah, like, for instance, I'll tell you one scenario that's been going around for a while is what happens when the permafrost opens up because of climate change, you know, in the north, in the high north. We don't know if there are viruses trapped in there that can survive extreme cold. And then will we have another pandemic because of that? So a lot of people are thinking about that. There is no evidence. It's just that we also don't have evidence to the contrary. We can't exclude that. And so then we wrote one scenario where we are imagining that an unidentified contagious disease emerges, and we don't know yet, is it from the permafrost? Maybe it's actually not that bad, but just the hysteria in the beginning could create a lot of negative effects. And then we're thinking through that. And also, how do you also, based on the COVID experience, how do you react very fast to rumors like that?
Are there some weak signals that you think people aren't taking it seriously, or ones that really captivate you personally?
So all the researchers are told that they should pick something that they think is overlooked. Right? So, I mean, it's kind of a weak signal is often overlooked because it's very early. I think one thing that I will consider a weak signal, but, you know, it's a weak signal for you and I maybe, but for others it's already mega prominent, is freedom of navigation issues in the high north, for instance, between the UK and Russia. They have, in the high north most of the year right now, there is a lot of ice, so ships can't circulate freely. But you had the on and off issues of Russia and the UK getting in a bit of a fight, nothing violent. But I'm thinking, okay, extend that to the future with the Nordic Sea Route opening up and more ships, including British ships, trying to travel to China for commercial reasons. Can we imagine a situation where this escalates into war, actually? So that is something, for instance, that I've been thinking about, coupled with another dimension to climate change, which is visibility issues. Visibility will drop because, you know, warmer weather means you have more humidity in the air, you have more fog. And then you add perhaps a satellite that doesn't function normally, the radars don't work. So these are small incidents that could escalate into full-on war. And so we think those through when we have a combination of climate change, commercial interests, and then already not very good diplomatic relations that could escalate. That's a weak signal that I'm very interested in. Freedom of navigation, especially in the high north. I understand it's also an issue in the Indo-Pacific. So that could be an interesting thing to look at together with partners like Australia.
Definitely. And it's been 2 weeks since you've been in Australia, is that mm-hmm. correct? And I know you've been meeting with a lot of, different military personnel and organizations and non-military people yeah. across the government. Are there things that you've learned about Australia since you've been here that you can perhaps share with us?
I've learned a great deal. So it's my first time in Australia. Of course, I had Australian friends before and so forth, but it's a completely different thing when you come here and also, of course, have a lot of exchanges, a lot of people that are working on the areas that I'm working on. So I came here with a blank slate. And with my European perception, and I was wondering what is the Australian strategic identity made of, you know, because every strategic identity has key elements, often taken from history, culture, and so forth. And as a European, I looked at the attack on Darwin by the Japanese Air Force, and I thought, surely that is a key ingredient of Australian thinking of itself. And I realized not at all. Not at all. Gallipoli is a lot more important. It popped up in a lot of conversations that I had, which coming from Europe, I thought, oh, that is so peculiar because I would never have expected that. So understanding Australian strategic identity, how it is very influenced, of course, by its operations, especially World War One, as I just said. But also the other thing that surprised me was, as an island, I would have expected the Australian identity to be much more naval, you know. But that was probably me taking my experience with the UK and thinking, well, the UK is an island, Australia is a massive island, but still. And I realized that's not the case either. The army in Australia is actually, they're all equal, I'm going to say, but the army is stronger than I thought. I thought surely, you know, Australia depends on shipping lanes and all that, right. Has had its conflicts also, you know, from a maritime point of view. And I thought, oh, surely it's a mega naval identity. It's not. So I've overturned a lot of my, not because of expectations, but stereotypes perhaps that I had constructed in my head before I came here. And I realized we have a lot in common. I mean, China is a strategic priority for Australia. For Europeans, it's Russia. But beyond that, these two are acting in a very similar way. You know, speaking of freedom of navigation, the South China Sea, the Nordic Sea Route, it looks very similar. And also the way they're building their military, rebuilding their military in Russia's case, also very similar. So I think at the minimum, we have a lot to share on how how actors that worry us, how they are behaving and what we can do about it.
Right. And I'd like to just ask if you could maybe unpack some of the differences but that you've experienced. Yeah, I know there are probably some similarities in that sort of context.
Between Russia and China? Of course. So Russia is a territorial power. So it sees itself, it is seen by Europeans as an army power. So it's territorial land warfare is basically, all the wars that we've had with Russia, World War One, World War, not World War One that much, but two, it was an territorial invasion at the time. So we don't see Russia as a naval power, whereas China is, I think, first and foremost a naval power because its vulnerability is, the way it sees itself is in that regard. But there's something changing when it comes to Russia. As I said, the opening of the Nordic Sea Route, Russia just finalized a new naval strategy for 2035. It's increasing its naval capabilities. Of course, a lot of its nuclear weapons are based on submarines in the north. So I think Europeans are wrong to think that Russia is not a strong naval power. So I think there is a difference in how these two handle this, but one is historical, the other is climate change related and commercially related and all that. So I think there is something common and something different. The other difference is, of course, Russia has a lot of military operational experience and China doesn't. So while we have seen Russia in action repeatedly against Ukraine, of course, but even before that, in Syria, we've seen it, of course, during World War II, we've seen it in Chechnya and so forth, and in Afghanistan in the 70s. So we have, from a research point of view, a lot of material to go on. What does Russia look like in action? And with China, all we know is that it's building, but we've never seen it in action. And I think that's an interesting conversation to have, because before a military force has been tried and tested, all of that is theoretical. They themselves don't know. We ourselves don't know what we're like when we're actually in action. I'll give you a parallel story from the Middle East. Until 2012, I think many observers would have dismissed Saudi military investments as, I can't remember, somebody said to me, oh, it's just for show, it's just for alliance building, buying American weapons to have a relationship with the US, etc. But I saw over more than 20 years, I saw a military buildup in Saudi Arabia that I thought, that's more than just signaling. They're getting ready for something. In my conversations with Saudis, the threat perception is very much related to Iran. So also, you could see that the way they were rebuilding their military or building their military, there was a very strong component that was Navy and Air Force and less Army. Well, yeah, if you look at the map, if you're Saudi Arabia and you're afraid of Iran, these are the two services that you will need the most. And then, of course, the operation in Yemen happened. And I'm not saying that was the reason why it happened, but I think it was de facto for Saudi Arabia and also for the UAE a way to test the way they do at war. It's an air war, so it would have experiences, it would have lessons learned from that experience that could be useful in a future war. So every military organization learns as they're doing. So equipment buying and training, that's useful, but that is not how you're going to be in an actual war. And I think that's the main difference between China and Russia. One is becoming a theoretical military power. The other has all this military experience. And so it's easier for us to learn from. It also makes them, I think, a scarier opponent because we know what they're capable of.
That's really interesting. And it makes me think of the kinds of ways in which our biases can kind of shape how we're thinking about the future in that regard, because we don't have that information. And so,
yeah.
How do we make sense of it? Or what are the stories we tell ourselves about China based on a sort of fog of war, incomplete
100%. I mean, biases they have a bit of a bad rep because, they distort our perception of reality. But I always say it's not like a disease. It's not like you can get rid of your biases. The most important thing is that you're aware of them. And that's the first step, is that when people ask, how do I get rid of a bias? Well, first of all, you can't get rid of it because it's your software. You've been coded that way. But you can identify it. And the way to identify it is very simple. The moment you realize that you have a very strong reaction to something, like and that will never happen, for instance, or I'm sure this will happen, then you know there's a bias at play. There's a shortcut. If you're interested in reading further, Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, he explains that. So system one is thinking fast. Mm-hmm. System two is thinking slow. You want to move more into system two. So develop methods to keep your biases in check. Ask yourself, can I contradict myself? Can I look at a conviction that I have and say, okay, I'm going to find evidence that it's not true? Just in your mind, you know, hold the two convictions and so forth. So, but 100% biases, there's an avalanche of literature on that in military history. Biases play a huge role in underestimating your opponent, overestimating, misreading your opponent, also misreading yourself. So it's very important that you develop a, I'm going to say a hygiene or a cognitive hygiene. Be aware of what information your mind has stored and how it classifies it. That's, I think, the trick.
And in anthropology, in my field, it often takes shape through stories, not just like a cognitive bias in the way that you're talking about, but the language that we use around, say, China's capability might be a story based on real information and evidence, but we fill in the gaps to kind of give it narrative and make sense of it. And those stories get reproduced and reproduced, and they become a sort of truth.
Yeah.
And that can sort of lead to the same things you were talking about, quick thinking of, oh, this is how we frame this problem. This is how we frame.
And you know why? Because humans, and in our particular field, humans hate uncertainty. Like, they hate uncertainty more than a negative reality. It's absurd. But so if you ask people, you know, do you want an electric shock now and be done with it, or wait 30 minutes and you have a two-thirds chance of getting it, or one-third chance of getting it, people will say, a lot of people will say, just give me the shock, I want to be done with it. Mm-hmm. And the same is at play here, in that it feels cognitively more reassuring to imagine the worst than to leave space for not knowing. And I think that's what you see a lot, which makes sense because a lot is at stake. You know, we're talking war. We're in an area of existential things, right? It's about life and death. So a lot of people will fall into catastrophic thinking because it's cognitively more reassuring than saying, you know what, we don't know what China will actually look like when it's at war.
Particularly as we're trying to prepare for certain eventual futures in that regard. It's really hard to look at that whole ambiguous, uncertain geopolitical environment and say, where do we put effort and training? And we are nearly at 30 minutes, but there's one more topic I'd really love your thoughts on. It's about the ADS recruitment and retention sort of ongoing issue. There were two articles published this month, actually, one in The Guardian that I read just today and another one on The Conversation. The Guardian one was actually quite interesting because it was mentioning that the ADF had introduced some new recruitment initiatives. They were posting ads on TikTok and in video games and, targeting, you know, younger people, and I guess, you know, talking about better pay and better conditions. And both these articles had talked about also a German initiatives that did similar things that had resulted in better recruitment. But generally, the ADF has experienced low recruitment and retention over the past 15 years. It's sort of been an issue. And a lot of these articles that have come out about why, I've often said stuff like, I think in The Conversation one, it actually mentioned a former Australian Army chief, Peter Larry, who blamed poor recruitment and retention on falling national pride. Mm. And there's a lot of negative assumptions about younger generations today, younger people. You know, they don't want to fight or go to war, or they're entitled as a generation and they don't know what it takes to, you know, join the military. And I know NATO's done some work in this, and you have some thoughts, and I'd just love to hear it.
Yeah, I'm laughing because we have exactly the same narratives in Europe and I will say probably also in the US. So we published a study. We did a huge study on Will to Fight. Actually, the title, full title, you can also get it on our website. So if you Google NATO Defense College, the title is Notwithstanding an Upbeat Perspective on Western Society's Will to Fight. And what we found, so we found exactly what you just described, you know, the Germans, the Brits, the French, no, actually not the French. The French is a different story. But in a lot of European societies, you have exactly that. Now, what's very interesting is that, first of all, you had very similar stories about the, you know, wild, the roaring 20s generation. You know, they're entitled and they're addicted to partying and alcohol and da da. And then, boom, Pearl Harbor happened and the recruitment offices were overrun in the US. So, I think there is no, what we know from research is that there is a thing called effective forecasting bias. So we're saying that the polls, if you rely on opinion polls, you know, ask people, would you fight for your country? We find that they're actually useless because people don't know how they would feel if it came to war. And that's not just in that situation. It's in many other situations. We're very good as humans to imagine a future situation. We're not good at creating the feeling that we will have in the future. We rarely know how we will feel about something in the future when it actually does happen. So we're saying the opinion polls, you can forget them. We're also saying that the people that say no to this question very often don't say no because they're not, what did you say, patriotic or proud of their country or whatever. Yeah. Very often, especially women or men over 45, they say no because they don't know how useful they would be in a situation like that. So we're saying all of these opinion polls, you can kind of forget them and they're asking the wrong question. What we do find, however, and that's important, I think, is... the way journalists and recruiters and whoever's part of this conversation frame this problem says a lot more about them. And we find that there are three types of people when it comes to the future. Either you think the future can be predicted based on the past, or you think the future, we cannot influence it. We can kind of, you know, adapt to it a little bit. But it's just, you know, it's like a train that's leaving a station and we can perhaps get on board or not. But there's not much we can do. And you have the third group, the influencers, the people that actually think you can influence the future. So you have the planner, the strategist, and the influencer, we called them in our study. And if you are a strategist or a planner, you will have exactly that narrative that you just heard. You will say, oh, we need these, you know, young, strong men, and, you know, willing to die for their country and all of that. The problem is when you have a narrative like that, that criticizes this generation, well, they're not going to come and want to work for you. You actually create exactly the situation that you're afraid of. You actually push recruitment rates down because you are creating a defeatist narrative that nobody wants to sign up to. I'll give you the counterexample of Finland. Finland is a very interesting case study because it's a small country, but it has a million reservists. It has 5.5 million people, a million reservists, total defense concept where all of society is involved. They know, should Russia come, we know exactly what to do. And you know what's interesting? They're also the happiest people on earth because they believe they can influence things. And their military institution doesn't believe in a 19th century image of, you know, masculinity or whatever. Just what you just described, like the Bundeswehr. Think of who is this generation that you want to fight with you, and then adapt to them, because a successful military institution adapts to the society it represents rather than expecting it to change, right? And I think the Bundeswehr did that very well, the German military, in their latest recruitment efforts. They're putting front and center the strong individualistic values of that younger generation, right? So it's about self-actualization, realizing your potential and all of that. So they're emphasizing that, and recruitment rates have increased by 30%. It's not just because of the recruitment campaign, of course, but I think it helps. And we also see, you know, contrary to this public perception, that the younger generation in Germany, people under 24, are the most likely to say yes to the question, would you defend your country? Because they're very politicized, very activist, and they believe, they want to feel that what they do has meaning. So I think it's very dangerous, actually, from a strategic point of view, to cater to that narrative that, you know, we wouldn't defend ourselves, etc. Because I can tell you who likes this narrative. It's Russia, in our case, and probably China and yours. So I invite you to check out the study because I think it's a very upbeat perspective, and it really invites you to take down that stereotype that Western societies are post-heroic and too woke to fight and whatever. I think none of that is true. Our studies show the opposite.
Oh, that's very interesting, and we'll link that study hopefully to the show notes of this episode. Florence, thank you so much. You've given us so many good food for thought for how to maybe think about the future, but also just speak so clearly about so many of these issues that kind of affect not just the EU, but Australia. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us
today. Thank you for having me.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial no derivatives 4.0 international license. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting the.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.